Thanks for listening to Only a Game. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. By supporting your local public radio station, you help us to serve and inform your community. Be informed, be connected, be a part of your public radio. Support public radio by visiting donate.npr.org/onlyagame, then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. During his NBA career, 11-time All-Star Charles Barkley was known for his combination of strength and skill.
Barkley and the foul.
Nowadays, Barkley, an analyst for Inside the NBA on TNT, is known for speaking his mind.
Listen, come on, man. You know, you can't serve cold nachos.
Oh, okay.
And the thing is, you know how, you know, some place they give you good nachos, they put jalapenos? The son's be putting pickles on it.
Barkley grew up in a single-parent household in rural Alabama. When his mom, Charcy, passed away in June of 2015, he took it hard. His whole hometown came to the funeral to pay respects. But there was also an unexpected guest. Here's reporter Shirley Wong.
Charles Barkley's friends couldn't quite place this mystery guest. He wasn't a basketball player, he wasn't a sports figure, and he wasn't from Barkley's hometown. Here's what I can tell you about him. He wore striped red polo shirts, tucked into khaki shorts, and got really excited about two-for-one deals. He was a commuter. He worked as a cat litter scientist in Muscatine, Iowa. In short, he was everyone's suburban dad. More specifically, he was my dad.
We know it was obviously a very difficult time.
That's Charles Barkley.
And the next thing I know, he shows up. Everybody's like, who's the Asian dude over there? And I just started laughing. I said, that's my boy Lynn. They're like, how do you know him? I said, it's a long story.
A long story that started 4 years ago.
He has a big personality.
That's my dad, Lynn Wong. I actually recorded this interview with him in 2017. He told me he knew about Charles Barkley long before he met him.
Well, yeah, he's a, you know, top 50 players in the history of the NBA. For many years, he was the number two guy, right after Michael Jordan.
Whenever we attended dinner parties, my dad would talk about his friend, Charles Barkley. The first time my dad told the story, I didn't pretend to know who this person was. Basketball has never been my thing. Like a good millennial, I Googled Charles Barkley. He seemed pretty famous, and definitely not like anyone who would be friends with my dad. About 2 years ago, I asked my dad if I could see their texts. They were mostly messages from my dad that ended with an excessive number of exclamation points. In one of the texts, in which my dad calls Barkley brother, my dad wrote, "Brother, you are so popular!" Watching your Capital One commercials in March Madness every year is almost like eating turkeys in Thanksgiving! It has become a must-do thing in March! Good for you! I told my dad the conversation seemed pretty one-sided and handed the phone back. As I talked about the relationship with more and more people, I began to think that either my dad was one of the luckiest basketball fans ever, or this whole thing was an elaborate joke, a dinner for schmucks type situation. But no, the friendship was real.
It was like one of the most random things.
Yeah, I was on a business trip and stayed in one of the hotels and was working in the lobby. And I saw Charles Barkley.
I was in Sacramento speaking at a charity event.
So I just wanted to say hi. I don't want to take a picture with him.
I was just sitting at the bar, and me and your dad were the only two people in there. And we just sit down and started talking.
He's a super nice guy.
And before we know it, we looked at each other like, yo, man, I'm hungry. And we said, well, let's go to dinner. It turned into a two-hour dinner. And then we actually went back to the bar and just sit there and talk for another couple hours. And the rest is history.
My dad and Barkley saw each other again in the bar the next night. And the night after that, at the end of the third night.
You know, certainly I told him I had a good time talking with him, hanging out with him. he said the same thing to me. And he left the phone number. He said, whenever you're in Atlanta, New York City, or Phoenix, check out with me. If I'm in town, we'll hang out, have a good time.
Over the next few years, whenever my dad was in those cities, he would text Barkley and they would hang out.
I mean, it's just a fun time. I mean, like when he came to Atlanta and came to the show and things, you know, my friends, Shaq, Ernie, Kenneth, they enjoyed just meeting him.
They got dinner together.
I think I had a Thai basil noodle. It was pretty good. I had it right inside the office.
Spent time on the set of Inside the NBA.
He likes to clean. There's several big can of cleaning wipes right on his desk. Every time he sit down, he clean his desk.
Watched basketball games.
And Iowa lost into Maryland that day.
I'm pretty sure they did some partying too, but that I don't know much about.
Your dad is one of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. I mean, I'm not just saying it. I mean, think about it. It's fun to be with your friends. You know, because like I don't have that many friends that I want to be around, to be honest with you. I mean, you know a lot of people, but when you go spend time with your friends, it's a whole different animal.
Back home, my dad's coworkers would tease him about Barkley and ask him about the story all the time. My dad didn't mind that they didn't believe him. He even made a slideshow of photos of him and Barkley together for our community's Chinese New Year celebration. Totally irrelevant to the holiday. Why do you think, like, out of all the people that he's interacted with, that you became friends with him? Like, what is it about you and him that made that last?
I think we had a good conversation. We agree with each other a lot of point of views. You know, he grown up in the 70s in Alabama. His father left him and his mother when he was little. He grown up with grandma and mother, and the grandma and mother cleaned up house for somebody else to make a living. Tough life for him. But you know, he's well-respected professionally. You know, that's his story.
My dad moved to Iowa from China in the 90s. He felt that Barkley and him had similar experiences.
So to me, as an Asian in the U.S., I felt as long as I do a good job, people will respect me.
Barkley and my dad both worked hard. So hard, they believed that the color of their skin didn't matter. In Chinese, we'd say that dad sometimes would hushu badao. That meant that sometimes he was known for spewing rubbish. I know that basketball fans might say Barkley often does the same.
Remembering the mother of Charles Barkley, today folks in Leeds said goodbye to Charcy Glenn. She died at her home this week.
When my dad heard on the news that Barkley's mother had passed away, my dad looked up the funeral details, hopped on a plane to Leeds, Alabama.
It ain't easy to get to those places. I'm from a very small town.
And my dad showed up for his friend. Afterwards, he went to dinner with Barkley and his family.
For your dad to take the time to come to the funeral meant a great deal to me.
Then, in May 2016, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. He had tumors in his heart. I took that fall off from school. My dad and I watched mobster movies together. Action movies. Kung Fu movies. When the credits rolled, we'd flip to a basketball game, just me and him, watching a lot of TV in our living room. Days passed by.
Whale of a playoff game in Oklahoma City tonight, and the Thunder even the series in the Western Conference semis with San Antonio.
Then months. Two
games of- From the set of Saturday Night Live in New York City, it's Inside the NBA.
Hello, hello.
With Charles Barkley.
Then it was 2 years.
And he never told you that he was sick, correct?
No, because I called him and got mad at him when I found out. I was like, dude, we're friends. You can tell me you're not bothering me. You know me well enough. If you were bothering me, I would tell you you were bothering me.
What Barkley didn't know was that my dad watched him almost every night on TNT. And while he rested and healed, my dad was laughing along with Barkley. He kept my dad company.
I think the Cavs bench is underrated.
June 2018, NBA Finals. Golden State Warriors versus Cleveland Cavaliers. My dad was staying in palliative care at the hospital. He loved the Warriors. I visited and read him sports highlights. He didn't get to watch J.R. Smith's late mistake in Game 1 live when Smith forgot the score. I tried to get him to laugh about Smith dribbling away from the hoop because he thought his team was ahead. But it was a Sunday afternoon, and my dad was tired. The summer light filled his room, then the day faded, and dusk began to enter. After it was all over, I went through my dad's phone and texted all his friends. I wrote, "Hi, this is Shirley. My dad just passed away." The funeral was the day after the NBA Finals. My dad's favorite team, the Golden State Warriors, had won the night before. The funeral was set near the outskirts of Iowa City in a house by the woods. I was talking to my childhood friend when she suddenly looked stunned. I turned to look behind me. And standing there, drenched in sweat from the Iowa summer, towering over everyone in the room at 6 feet 6 inches tall, was Charles Barkley.
I had not met anybody in your family. I didn't know anybody there.
But we all knew you.
Everyone watched, astonished as this man we only knew from TV, this worldwide celebrity, walked down the aisle, looked at us, and sighed. Later, after it all, I texted Barkley and asked him, "Why my dad? Why did he matter so much to you?" And recently, I called him up and asked, "What did you even have to talk about?"
Well, I think, well, first of all, clearly he was a fan.
Right, big time.
But I think the main thing we talked about was you and your brother.
What did you guys talk about? What did he say?
Well, I think it was more that he was proud. And because I got a daughter, too. I'm just really, really proud of her because I think she's a good person. And your dad was so proud of you and your brother. And we just talked about, listen, as an adult, and you too young to understand this now, and all you want is your kids to be happy. That's what you work for, to give your kids everything in life.
The more Charles Barkley and I talked, I realized just how close he and my dad were. Barkley knew so much about me and my life, even though this is the first time he and I had ever talked.
It gives me great memories and great joy to know that that I was a friend of his. Just hearing about him at the funeral, what he had accomplished, and what he was trying to help other people accomplish, just made me even. I wish he bragged more about himself.
So let me get this straight. You were impressed by him.
Yeah.
At the funeral, people shared memories of my dad and made me realize that, for example, he was not just a cat litter chemist, but an industry-changing scientist with a PhD, and not just an immigrant, but someone who reached out to Chinese newcomers, and not just a thoughtful guy, but someone people trusted for advice. I realized that even after he passed away, I would continue to learn things about my dad.
Hey, listen, you stay in touch. Please tell your mom I said hello, give her a big kiss. Tell your brother I said hello. And listen, just keep doing you. It's your time now. Don't forget that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the most important thing. Your dad prepared you to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
He prepared you for that.
All right.
I was blessed to know him and know you too.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, baby. You take it easy here.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
I know how much his friendship with Charles Barkley meant to my dad. It was not just a relationship with a celebrity. It shed light on the possibilities of this world. A world where someone like him could just say something cool, something charming, and befriend someone like Charles Barkley. I'm so glad that now I get to share my dad's number one dinner party story.
That's reporter Shirley Wong. In 1923, sports writer George Cairns described French tennis star René the Crocodile Lacoste this way.
Tenacious on his grip, flashing an omnivorous, toothy grin, he was relentless and chewed up his opponents slowly.
A decade later, Lacoste launched a major fashion brand. Maybe you've heard of it. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Former University of Maryland head football coach DJ Durkin reportedly has a new job at Alabama. And that's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by Julie DeCaro, sports writer and host at Chicago's 670 The Score via Skype, and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Julie, please remind our listeners who DJ Durkin is and tell us what's going on with him now.
My pleasure. Well, when last we left DJ Durkin, he was being fired by the University of Maryland following the death of player Jordan McNair from heat stroke during a spring practice. An ensuing investigation found that players were regularly bullied, verbally and emotionally abused by coaches and the conditioning staff, including having players watch videos of serial killers at work and eyeballs being drilled into during team meetings. It would seem that DJ Durkin maybe should sit down in the corner and take a break from coaching for a while, but no, he's now been hired by Nick Saban as a consultant. You guys, this is just the latest in a long line of college coaches who leave a school due to a devastating scandal and then immediately get hired somewhere else. So there just seems to be no end in sight for the way that college coaches seem able to bounce back from deeds that would probably land other people in jail.
I'm fully with you. I want to say there is some good in college sport. There's a lot of good that comes for the young men and women that participate. But you're absolutely right. I'm shocked that DJ Durkin is resurrected so soon. But what happens in sport, and with this issue and with others, the desire, the need to win is so powerful that if somebody has a skill set, they get hired. Unless, as you point to, they're incarcerated. If you're available, there's still a chance that you will be hired by a team. And I'm not saying these guys should be incarcerated. You know, we can talk a lot about the kinds of violations that have taken place. You know, Ohio State, it was tattoos, or at North Carolina, it was grades. But this is actually a player dying.
Yeah.
While, and you know, I always look to the guy or the woman on the top. Durkin was the head coach at that moment. So, you know, if we want to know what's the most severe thing you can be engaged in, short of an actual crime, and still get hired again, Durkin has shown us what that is.
The desire to win does sort of start to override everything. But I mean, you've got a coach like DJ Durkin. I mean, Maryland wasn't that great under him. I mean, they were like, what, six and seven?
Yeah. Very good point.
Yeah, my first thought was, you know, maybe this Durkin guy has a secret blackmail dossier on everyone in college football, and that's how he keeps getting hired. But then I realized that people in college football aren't in a position to hold Durkin accountable, because then they'd have to hold themselves accountable. I mean, do we really think that Maryland is the only place where disturbing videos are being shown to players, or where a member of the training staff threw a trash can filled with vomit at a player, and the report says, oh, don't worry, that only happened once? And we know that Maryland is not the only school where a player has died because no one was paying attention. So I think head coaches really do believe that it's their job to win, and it's someone else's job to take care of all this other stuff. And I think It's our job as fans, as journalists, as students, as players, to tell them that they're wrong in that estimation. And that's kind of what happened at Maryland, and maybe it should happen at Alabama too. What do you think, Julie?
The more that we hear from college football coaches and the way they sort of think about these things, the more appalled I think a lot of the fan base becomes. And, you know, I guess I'm glad on the one hand that fan bases do stand up and object and say this is not okay with us, but it's just exhausting.
Ken, it's your turn.
The big story this week for me is the National Football League revising the Rooney Rule. And this rule came about at a moment where there was a great deficit in the number of coaches of color in the National Football League. But the rule says, quite simply, initially, you must interview at least one minority, that's the word the rule uses, when you are hiring a new head coach. It was revised in 2009 to say, for any front office position, so general manager, president, like, you must interview at least one minority candidate. And the rule in general has had great success. Then last year, the Oakland Raiders end up hiring John Gruden. And essentially, by the analysis of many, they didn't interview anybody else. They did not comply with the Rooney Rule. They did bring in their tight end coach, Bobby Johnson. And they also had a form of an interview with the USC offensive coordinator, a guy named T. Martin. That kind of sham is not going to be allowed anymore. Any team that is going to interview for a new head coach must at least interview one candidate from what's called the Career Development Advisory Panel list. Most people refer to it as the list. And that would compel a team to interview somebody that's not currently on their team, not to just go to the locker room and grab the person of color and say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this job.
I think it's a good change. You know, obviously the Rooney Rule has become the eyes of a lot of teams, it's become sort of a technicality, like, oh, we got to comply with the Rooney Rule. I know there was a story in the Denver Post recently, maybe in the last year or so, talking about the fact that, you know, there are a lot of like linebacker coaches and stuff who are black men, but not necessarily in those coveted positions of coordinators, who are the guys who move up into the head coaching ranks typically. I don't know that much is going to change with the Rooney Rule until the NFL starts making it hit teams financially, right? I think only one team has ever been fined, and it was the Detroit Lions back in like 2003, and they got fined like $200,000 for not complying with the Rooney Rule, which they probably have in their couch cushions, right? When you have a league that is so prominently populated by African-American men, to then have white men making all these decisions, and I think that the Colin Kaepernick situation sort of played out, and you can see the complete and total lack of understanding by a lot of the people in positions of authority in the NFL, and that includes head coaches.
Yeah, I think we're all in complete agreement that the NFL really does need to focus on this issue. But, you know, I got to say, in a world where Bill Belichick has a job, I wonder if interview skills are really what head coaches are hired for. You know, it is almost impossible to get the head coaching job without being a coordinator first. So I wonder, like, why isn't there a rule that applies to coordinators? And you can't get the coordinator job without being an assistant first or being a position coach first. So why doesn't this rule also apply to those jobs? Ken, am I asking too much of the NFL here?
No, but you're talking to a monolith of an institution. As I said, it took 6 years to move from just head coach to include front office positions. So maybe things like that you're talking about are on the horizon.
Well, turning to the NBA, Josh Hart is a guard for the LA Lakers, and he's doing pretty well for a second-year player. He's averaging more than 9 points and 3 rebounds in 25 minutes per game. But there is one aspect of his game that is now the subject of a video breakdown, complete with appropriately dramatic music. Cue the music, please, Marquise. So Josh Hart is struggling to make contact with his teammates for in-game high fives. Yes, that's right. Hart has connected on just 28% of the high fives he has attempted. I love this story, and I love that people love this story. You know, I mean, who among us hasn't waved hello to someone who was waving hello to someone else, or gone in for the hug when the other person was going in for the handshake? And I kind of wonder, is this why we love this story so much? Ken, what do you think?
They got to be punking him. I mean, if we can still use that phrase. I mean, it really, you know, this guy is missing every high five. And it's not just, I mean, this is just worth looking at. It's not just that he's missing. People are ignoring him completely. And I'm just like, how does it happen? And not just once, but over and over again. So I just can't, is this for real? This is, you know, all this other stuff we were talking about earlier. This is really the burning question of the week. What's going on here?
Julie, what do you think?
As also a challenged high fiver, I can relate to this issue. I think it's a depth perception thing. I don't know. Like, I struggle with this as well, especially when people are taller than me. But, you know, the thing that this makes me think about is the fact that the NBA, when it comes to Twitter memes and social media and the enthusiasm of their fan base, I think is just unparalleled in sports. You know, I think a lot of this is the fact that the NBA has no restrictions on what fans can do with their on social media, right? They're not going to come after you for posting GIFs or for posting highlights because they don't want their fans to miss a second of what's happening. And so it leads to this kind of thing, which is fun for everyone involved. And then it leads to more people watching the NBA.
I think I have nothing left to say except, Marquise, can we play the music again? My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro, sports writer and host at Chicago's 670 The Score, and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
High five.
Tim Clapp was only 5 years old when his grandfather, George Cairns, died, but he remembers him well.
Well, he was an incredible person. He was gregarious and fun and funny and smart.
Clapp has heard all the stories about his grandfather, including the one about how he helped launch one of the world's most lucrative fashion brands, sort of. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Times were tough for the Cairns family at the turn of the century. So young George quit school in 1908 when he was a teenager.
He got a job at the Boston Herald as a copy boy. And it was a happy accident because he had to get the scores from all of the towns in the entire state. And he had to call everybody, which allowed him to get to know everybody.
By 1910, Cairns was covering school sports for the Boston Herald Traveler. It was a great time to be a sports writer. Soon, newspapers all over the country would feature splashy headlines trumpeting the exploits of Babe Ruth, Newt Rockne, Jim Thorpe, Bill Tilden, and other superstars. Over the next 5-plus decades, Cairns went everywhere.
He never missed a Harvard-Yale football game between 1908 and 1960. He went to the Amsterdam Olympics in 1928, covered that. In 1928, he was at the Roland Garros Stadium that had just been built, watching Tilden and Lacoste.
Rene Lacoste was one of the biggest male tennis stars of that time. Cairns was covering tennis for one of the Boston dailies. He'd gotten to know Lacoste a few years earlier.
He always wanted to meet the new and upcoming stars, so he made it a point to introduce himself and get to know him in 1923 when he came to Longwood.
The Longwood Cricket Club, located just outside Boston, was the site of the first Davis Cup competition in 1900. In August of 1923, Team France was there to play Team Australia for a spot in the finals against the U.S. On an off day, Lacoste, Team France captain Alan Muir, and George Cairns took a stroll in a ritzy Boston neighborhood.
I remember my mother and my grandmother talking about it a lot.
And yet, no one can agree which street they strolled on.
And they're walking down the street, and they're just talking about the upcoming match against Australia. They stopped at a fine luggage store, and there was a beautiful crocodile valise in the big picture window.
Lacoste noticed it.
And he really took a shine to it and fancied it and made a big deal about it.
There's another disagreement about what happened next. In one version of the story, the team captain said,
"If you win your match tomorrow, I'll buy it for you." And in the other one, Lacoste said, "If I win it, will you buy it for me?" But either way, it's the same idea. And unfortunately, he lost his match to a guy named Anderson from Australia.
Actually, that's not true. Lacoste didn't play in that tournament. But France did lose to Australia. Whatever the real story is, Lacoste didn't get his coveted crocodile bag. But the story didn't end there. He got something more valuable.
My grandfather was there and heard and wrote an article about it, started calling him the crocodile. Over the years, he used to write lots of articles about him, and the name stuck.
It stuck in part because of the way Cairns described Lacoste's playing style.
He basically said that the crocodile described him perfectly, tenacious on his grip, flashing an omnivorous, toothy grin. He was relentless and chewed up his opponents slowly. But without a doubt, the valise was the genesis of it.
That gave Lacoste an idea.
He took advantage of it by having his suitmaker or haberdasher start putting these alligator logos on his sports coats and his hats and everything else he was wearing.
And Lacoste didn't like traditional tennis garb.
He was the first guy to get rid of sleeves on his shirt. He was the first guy to wear short sleeve shirts. He created this style himself.
The tennis world noticed, and a brand was launched. After World War II, Lacoste sold the foreign rights to his design and logo. By the early 50s, the Lacoste jersey was popular in the U.S.
And then over the years, it expanded into the iconic brand that it is now. And so they've obviously made a fortune.
During the 1970s and 80s, the Izod Lacoste brand enjoyed annual sales of over $150 million for its shirts alone. In 2014, Tim Clapp and his family took a vacation to Paris. They paid a visit to the Lacoste flagship store.
I told them the story, and they got very excited about it and wanted to tell the head of the company, whoever that was at the time. And they called him at his estate in Switzerland, and he was unavailable, so I never got to connect with him. But someday I still hope to contact his grandson, who I believe is still involved with the company, and compare notes about our grandfathers.
At this point, you're probably wondering the same thing I am. Did George Cairns ever make any money off of his inadvertent branding of René Lacoste's fashion juggernaut?
No, but we always joked we never saw any royalties, but he knew tennis royalty when he saw it.
For the record, Clapp doesn't think Lacoste owes his family royalties, but he does wish the company would acknowledge Cairns' role in the development of one of the most recognizable logos in the world.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. George Cairns died in 1962 at the age of 69. He covered sports right up until the end of his life. Chevy Vithyanathan grew up in Sri Lanka, where he played cricket as often as he could. But in 1983, civil war broke out.
That's when I realized I need to get out.
How Chevy found cricket again, coming up on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game listeners, have you supported your local public radio station yet? Now's the time. Go to donate.npr.org/onlyagame, then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week, how DJ Set Free and the And One mixtapes brought hip-hop to the NBA. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Time to talk Heisman. Are you ready with the pose?
Hold it.
All right. Well done. Oklahoma quarterback Kyler Murray received 517 first-place votes to come out on top. Good choice?
Yeah, I think so. I would have voted for him. He was certainly the most entertaining player I saw all year. And, you know, he's an interesting enough guy. He's got a tremendous future in baseball, apparently.
Absolutely. He's already signed a $4.66 million contract with the Oakland A's. So, of course, there's been a ton of speculation this week. Will Murray forego a hefty portion of his signing bonus to pursue a two-sport career? What would you do, Charlie?
I would probably stay away from the NFL wherever possible. The step up from the minor leagues to the major leagues is so big that, you know, Kyler Murray could probably step in and start for an NFL team next year. I don't know if he could start for a Major League Baseball team as a shortstop next year. But I'd rather see him play baseball because then he'd be better able probably to talk and walk and think when he was 50. So
absolutely. Well, many say that Murray wouldn't be coveted as a quarterback in the NFL. He's too small, just 5'10". And it's always crazy to me that in this league, if you don't have the ideal height, the ideal weight, the stereotypical skin color for the position you're playing, you don't have a chance no matter good you are.
And the interesting thing about that, of course, is people keep making the same mistake over and over and over and over again. And they draft these wonderfully handsome, largely Caucasian, tall, cannon-armed guys who can't make a decision to save their lives.
After continued controversy over now former Kansas City Chief Kareem Hunt's assault case, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said this week that the league will not pay for video footage, virtually guaranteeing that TMZ will always know what players have done before the league does.
And we will.
And we will.
Which is more important.
Does the league not have the dough?
I don't know what this is all about. He seems to think that buying video that belongs to someone else is somehow being bribed. And if there's one thing the NFL would never do, it would never take money for services. Roger Goodell's a fool. He has no idea what to do with this issue. He's never had any idea what to do with this issue. And every time he tries to do something with this issue, he gets it wrong and makes it worse.
Robert Sarver, owner of the Phoenix Suns, has apparently threatened to move the team to Seattle or Las Vegas if the city doesn't contribute $150 million toward arena renovations. And from the sounds of it, Phoenix might miss the team, but they wouldn't miss the owner, right?
No, they're perfectly willing to let him leave town. You know, I think they probably miss the team, but there's no way they should give in to this kind of blackmail. And Seattle ought to be ashamed for even sniffing around this, given what happened to them with the Supersonics in Oklahoma City. But there's no question that the city fathers in Phoenix should call this guy's bluff.
Sarver has been an objectively terrible owner over the past 14 years, but the franchise has still tripled in value. And yet, if the public hadn't gotten wind of it, the city was apparently ready to vote in the subsidies. Did they think nobody would miss the $150 million?
Well, I think that the public visibility of these kind of issues has gotten so high in the last 15 or 20 years. And it's almost universally negative, which I think is a good thing because there was an enormous amount of waste in these proposals before.
I learned this week that no one should turn to Warriors star Steph Curry for news about science. Explain, please.
Well, he says he was kidding. He says we didn't really land on the moon. I think it was just a sucker play to get a tour of the NASA facility, which he's going to get.
The NHL has confirmed this week that directly does not mean directly. What?
Yeah, a shot went off a referee and technically went in off a referee's nether regions and went into the net and has been declared a not goal because actually there's a rule that says a goal is disallowed when the puck has deflected directly into the net off an official, and I would like to add, ouch.
Well, in this case, it apparently hit another player on the way
which
makes it not directly. But...
Well, you know what? It's not a goal, and I feel bad for the referee, and I hope he's doing better.
ESPN has ranked the worst stadiums for high-level food service violations. These are things like employees wiping their faces and then touching the food.
Ooh.
And beer leaking from the ceiling. I hope nobody drank that. And I don't even care who's the worst anymore. I'm thinking I shouldn't eat in any of these places.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to have beer leaking from the ceiling than from the employees, I guess. But yes, there were also some vermin problems. Mm. If you're really interested, the three venues with the highest rates of violation were the Spectrum Center in Charlotte, the now-closed Palace of Auburn Hills near Detroit, which does not surprise me at all, and the American Airlines Center in Dallas. The lowest violation rates are NRG Stadium in Houston, the State Farm Arena in Atlanta, and the Oracle Arena in Oakland, where you can doubt the moon landing but probably feel the food is safe.
Well, I'm glad that Fenway wasn't on the worst list because I can't give up the short rib grilled cheese.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
And finally, Charlie, Jose Canseco has tweeted at President Donald Trump, and I'm just going to let you take it from there.
Yeah, first of all, he calls him Little Buddy, as in, hey, little buddy. He wants to be the White House chief of staff, or as Jose put it, the chief if staff, which is probably more accurate than Jose meant. And hashtag, yes, we Canseco. I'll be dying to watch the nuclear codes go off his head and out the window.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
So I see you walking down the halls, but I don't know you very well, so tell me who you are.
I'm Walter Withman. I'm a producer here at WBUR. I work for the afternoon show Radio Boston and also on the news desk.
But this time last year, you were not living in Boston, right?
No. I was living in Sri Lanka, and I was working for an English language newspaper in the capital, Colombo.
And tell me about the first time you remember seeing cricket.
It might have been on, like, my second or third day there. just on a TV. Tuk-tuk drivers, which are like the taxis, are listening to it. In my office, which is was a big newspaper, they had this old TV in the corner, and on those big game days, they would just sit and watch that TV. Very little work got done.
And of course, it was all cricket in the paper the next day, so that's fine, right?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, so when you moved to Boston, you must have thought your cricket days were over.
I really did. I really did.
And then you met this guy.
But I met Chevy.
My name is Inpachelvin Vithyanandan. I go by Chevy here.
Chevy Vithyanandan is from Sri Lanka, the small island nation off the coast of India. He grew up under the shade of coconut palms, going to school, doing chores, getting in trouble, but mostly playing cricket. In Sri Lanka, cricket is not just a sport. It's an obsession that borders on religious devotion.
If the national team is playing a cricket game, the whole country shuts down. Because everybody's either listening to it on the radio in my days or probably watching it on TV these days. Nobody pays any attention to anything else.
Chevy doesn't remember the first time he played cricket.
Probably as soon as I could carry a bat is probably when I played cricket. Probably man-made as well, not a store-bought bat.
Chevy says he still has the calluses he got on the cricket pitch as a kid.
We take a bus to school most of the time, and there's always a game going. So we play it before school starts, and then we have a lunch break, which is like 45 minutes. And most of us bring sandwiches. We'll probably finish eating before even lunch starts. And, you know, you run into the field to try and secure a spot to play cricket.
And when school ended, there was, of course, more cricket. Chevy says if not for cricket, he wouldn't have been very interested in going to school.
Cricket and our life as kids were the same, you know.
But in high school, things began to change. It was 1983, and ethnic tensions in Sri Lanka were high. In the decades since independence from the British, the government had passed discriminatory laws favoring the Sinhalese majority over the Tamil minority. By the 1980s, young Tamils were forming armed groups. They wanted their own separate state. Chevy is Tamil, and as a teenage boy growing up in the dusty northern town of Jaffna, he was the perfect target for recruitment by the guerrillas.
And they would come into the schools and will, you know, distribute pamphlets and you know, you saw guns and it wasn't safe for you.
Chevy had to navigate a treacherous world. On one side were the Tamil militias and on the other, the military.
You don't have to be involved in anything. It's just by the fact that you're an 18-year-old boy was not a good thing.
In July of 83, a young militant group known as the Tamil Tigers attacked an army convoy. Almost immediately afterwards, massive retaliatory riots consumed Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. Chevy's brother was living there at the time. He'd call home to tell his family he was safe. Chevy says he waited in dread between those calls. The riots went on for a week. By the end, Sinhalese mobs had killed an estimated 3,000 Tamil civilians and burned whole neighborhoods to the ground.
That's when I realized I need to get out.
Chevy had already spent a year as an exchange student in upstate New York. He knew he needed to leave again. So he applied to the State University of New York in Fredonia and got accepted. A family agreed to host him. So as the ashes in Colombo were cooling, Chevy boarded a plane to the United States. He had no idea how long he'd be away from home.
First time I arrived was in August, towards the end of August. I was wearing jeans, I was wearing two t-shirts and a jean jacket, and I was cold. Must have been in the 70s.
The weather was different, the food was different. Gone were the chilies and cinnamon and cardamom of Sri Lankan curries. Instead, there was spaghetti and casserole.
My first few weeks, it probably made my host mother very upset because I needed hot sauce on everything she prepared, and I'm pretty sure she wasn't very happy with that.
But what Chevy says he missed most was cricket. His new home in upstate New York was full of baseball diamonds and football fields, but no cricket pitches. To fill the void, he initially tried out for football, which is how he got his nickname.
Back home, they called me Chelvin. So when I came here, I went by Chelvin. But my first week or second week here, school starts, and I said, I want to play football. So I went to go football practice, and the coach asked me what my name was, and I said, Chelvin. He goes, Chevy. That was it. Since then, I've been Chevy.
Chevy stuck with football for just one season, but softball seemed like a better fit.
The hardest thing was catching the ball with the mitt. I just wasn't natural. I play in the outfield, and when the ball comes in, I throw the mitt, catch it with my hands because I was afraid the ball was going to hit my head if I caught it with the mitt. They all laughed. I mean, you know, they thought I was crazy, but it was easier.
He eventually got the hang of it, but it still wasn't cricket. Back home, the war raged on.
Malaysia's longest-running war has torn apart the country, with civilians caught in the middle, desperately trying to fend for themselves.
The bloody aftermath of a suicide attack on a security checkpoint in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo.
Time is now running out for the Tamil Tigers. The Sri Lankan government has given them till noon on Tuesday to surrender or face further military action.
Years of conflict became decades. Chevy thought he'd never play his childhood game again. And he didn't, for 30 years. In that time, he went to SUNY and then MIT and graduated with an engineering degree. He met his wife, and they had two children. He celebrated holidays with other Tamils in New England. He watched the Patriots on Sundays and felt far away from home. Until one day, about 6 years ago...
One of the guys at one of the Tamil events said, hey, you know, we play cricket on Sundays. And I said, oh, I'll come up. It felt foreign. I mean, I could not. It took me almost 10 days of playing cricket before I could make contact with the bat and the ball, because it's the whole softball motion or the baseball motion is different from cricket, and I just kept missing every ball.
Sunday after Sunday, Chevy was out on the makeshift cricket pitch behind a school in his neighborhood. They'd play on a baseball diamond, one wicket at home plate and the other on second base. Chevy started getting closer with the guys he played with. A few were his age, who'd fled Sri Lanka at the beginning of the war, but there were many younger players as well, with much more recent memories of the homeland they'd fled.
Even though, you know, age differences, the stories are the same. The talk about cricket and the games and, you know, the high school rivalries are still there, and we still have those rivalries here, so it's who we were.
Chevy now plays in tournaments against teams from other Tamil expat communities up and down the East Coast.
Saturday early morning, the games start, and there will be breakfast served at the field, and it'll be a good Sri Lankan meal. In Sri Lanka, everything revolves around food as well. So lunch will be served, and it's all home-cooked dishes.
The game, the meals, the people, they connect Chevy to his past. By the time Chevy started playing cricket again, the war had ended. For the first time, he began to think seriously of moving back home. After the military left some of the former war zones, he visited Sri Lanka and returned to the house he grew up in.
There's bullet holes and, you know, windows missing and roof caved in and walls broken and so on and so forth. So it's hard to... Hard to come to grips with it, you know, because that's where you grew up, but it was what it was. I mean, people had it worse.
Chevy's uncle's house across the street was in similar shape. So he fixed it up. He replaced the windows. He replaced the roof. He returned to New England and lobbied his wife to split their time. 6 months in the U.S., 6 months in Sri Lanka.
It's home. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It's home.
But 3 months ago, all those calculations changed again. In October, the democratically elected president very undemocratically fired his prime minister and appointed Mahinda Rajapaksa, the former president who's accused by the UN of presiding over massive war crimes against Tamils. For Chevy, it means he doesn't know if he can go back. But at least, he says, he now has cricket again. How long do you see yourself playing?
It's a good question. As long as my body lets me.
That story came from reporter Walter Wuthman. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help this week from Nico Emack, Alex Schroeder, and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.